Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Gold took a beating. Ross looks at the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, discusses what lies ahead for high-tech stocks, gold, and crude. He also comments on whether we're headed for a recession. Martin also has a special offer for you. Publisher of WolfStreet.com, Wolf Richter, checks in from San Francisco. He tells us there's actually a positive side to climbing interest rates. He examines the auto sector and where the stock markets are headed. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Jim.
Do we have a special offer for our listeners this week?
Yeah, we're getting down to the end here. We've got 25% off as of this final weekend, the end of September, the end of the calendar quarter, which historically, this is getting into that window where the weakness in the equity markets provides both opportunity on the way down, as we have seen in this last 6 to 8 weeks. And then between now and the end of October, you look for some exceptional lows. And historically, this is where you get some of your best bargains of the year. And we've got our various signals that we use, the capitulation signals, and then we'll look for other stocks which are starting to show relative strength against the indices. There's already a few that are starting to show that already, having put in higher lows this week than they did 2 weeks ago. So there are some opportunities starting to just show some sign of light, and hopefully we will be on board with those in October. And for anyone taking out a new subscription, it's 25% off. So we would welcome you to take advantage of this opportunity.
What was the story in the stock markets this week?
Well, I mean, this is we're into that period, as I say, where things get heavy. The S&P had a little bit of an upside swing there on Thursday and Friday, but overall, a poor week and a poor month as far as September is concerned. You know, this last week we're down, badly on the week overall. You've got, 30-point break as far as the S&P is concerned. The bounce on Friday only got back to the August lows that we had cracked. And as far as the NASDAQ, which had been the leader on the upside for months and months, it's now tested that August low, and it's just straddling it at this point. But overall, we got some oversold signals on Wednesday and Thursday, enough that you would get sort of a 1 to 4 day bounce. It looks as though that might be what we saw on the second half Thursday and into Friday, but we need to see a better base than is there right now. And as I say, if this double top or head and shoulders that people are looking at takes hold, it's now up to the market to show that it's got support and is capable of turning.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Interesting. Currency-wise, we ended up with the U.S. dollar ETF, the UUP. It got up and had its first exhaustion signal on the upside that we'd seen since October of last year. And on the other side of the coin, the British pound, the Swiss franc, the Mexican peso, and the euro all put in good oversold signals on their lows of this week. And once again, going back for many, many months. So the could be that we're looking at a pivotal low as far as the Europeans and the Mexican and currencies are against the U.S. dollar. Now, the Canadian, this is interesting. In the last couple of weeks, we've had this great move as far as the oil market was concerned and the CRB index, Commodity Research Bureau index, on the upside. The Canadian dollar has failed to participate in the last rally. So we've got a very big divergence sitting up here. And, you know, it was 20 years ago that we started to look at divergences as being a fairly regular item on the Canadian dollar. About half of the turns occurred when there was a divergence relative to the CRB or the oil market. And what we've seen just here this last week or two is one of those divergences that sets up for a pretty good break on the downside. Now, as you recall, we had been oversold. We got the rally to 74.5, but that one is now not just petered out. The fact is that it's at a lower high relative to an oil market that kissed $95 this week. So when the Canadian can't do well with good support behind it, then you know it's going to be in trouble as soon as things start to subside. And, you know, the other thing that could be supportive to the dollar that's not happening is the interest rate differential between U.S. and Canada. You know, it's usually going to be anywhere between 1% differential on the downside to 1% premium on the upside. Right now, we're at about 0.5%. It's not enough to be supportive to the dollar. And, you know, without that, and maybe with commodities taking a bit of a breather, then Canadian does not look too promising in the near future.
What's the story on gold?
This strength in the U.S. dollar, finally, we ended up seeing the gold market take its crack. And we had been, you know, hoping here that we would be looking for a reasonable low. The scenario that we needed was to see not only the test of support, but to take out the resistance levels that we had seen in the last couple of months. So as we stepped down, July's high was important, then the August high around 1955 on the cash. And then 2 weeks ago, we're looking at even lower. As of this week, we've cracked. We're down to around 1845. You would normally, on this type of a move that we've had in the last year, like back in November, we were down at 1630 just last November, and made the rally to 2050. 50% correction is here approaching us at 1840. 60% would be at 1800, and you know, we're going to keep an eye out and see if we get a capitulation signal. Maybe a quarter of the gold bottoms have capitulations in them. The other ones are what we look at as isolated lows. Where you put in a low and then quickly come back and take out resistance. This one needs a little bit of time to develop. Seasonally, we are still early. Typically, the bottom in the gold, the gold miners, would be closer to November. So we'll have patience waiting for this sector to come into place. And once it does, then the miners should be a good place to step into. And the levered ETF there, the NUGT, would be something for the investors or speculators to take a look at.
Ross, where can people go again to get that special offer?
Chartsandmarkets.com, and on the front page there you will see the 25% offer.
Thank you so much, Ross.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Coming up, Martin Strath, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, well, thank you, Jim. Good to be back.
Can you tell us a bit about the Trend Letter?
Yeah, sure. We have three services. So we have the Trend Letter, which was the original one back in 2002. So we're in our 21st year now. So it publishes every Sunday evening, covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. And what we do there is we really tie in how all of these markets are connected. As I say, it's issued weekly. The audience here is for longer-term investors, and really for people who want to get a better understanding of what's driving these markets. The second one is Trend Technical Trader. So that's originally a hedging service, but it also now does long positions. It covers, commodities, equities, precious metals, and it includes the proprietary gold technical indicator. The audience there for more active investors, but any investor, and certainly long-term investors, have certainly benefited from a number of these hedging strategies as well. We've got the other third one would be Trend Disruptors. So that invests in disruptive ideas, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things, all the cool stuff. Very speculative sector. And it's really for people that, who want to speculate, that only want to do it with the risk capital they can afford to lose. And maybe at the end of this, Jim, we're going to offer some specials. We're, again, trying to help raise the money for Special Olympics. So we're going to offer some specials, and then we'll do some donations to Special Olympics.
What's your take on the stock markets today?
Well, we've been selling subscribers for quite a while to prepare that, August and September are the weakest months for equities. And, the last week of September is the worst week. So, that seasonal trend has certainly played out almost perfectly here. We've seen the S&P down about 7% in that time frame through, August and September so far. So, what we've seen then is very normal. And, within bull and bear market, seeing a 5-10% correction, that's not just normal. It's also very healthy for the market. So now the key for us is the S&P has dropped below its 50-day moving average and its 100-day moving average. Just looking right here now, it's just closed at 4288 here on Friday. Now its 200-day moving average is just below 4200. And that happens to coincide with its year-long uptrend line. So that's a really key support level. So if we break below 4,200, that would certainly suggest that, things are going to get a little bit more dicey here. But right now, we have a number of indicators that we watch and our models use to kind of track, when we're going to see kind of a top and a bottom, or at least a turning point. So you've got one of them is relative strength. Just the other day, it was at 26. And, any reading under 30 is considered to be extremely oversold. So we should see at least a rally soon. Now, in the bigger picture, The S&P has been in a strong uptrend channel since, you know, since the financial crisis 2008. So, you know, that bottomed out about 2009, and it's been in an uptrend channel ever since then. So the bottom rung of that uptrend channel now, it sits at just under 4,000. So if we see the S&P drop below, you know, that 4,200 I just mentioned earlier, and then if it drops below the 4,000 level, then we could see some, you know, we could see some, we should be heading for a much deeper correction. Now, since August and September are the weakest months based on seasonality, I think your investors, your listeners should know that that weakness typically will run into the first half of October. So, you know, investors need to be aware of that. But, you know, from mid-October to the year end, that's typically the strongest period for equities. You know, since 1990, the S&P 500 has been up 74% of the time in that, you know, mid-October to the year end timeframe. So, you know, based on seasonality, we should be seeing some excellent buying opportunities soon. You know, sectors that we've got on our, that we're looking at, you know, we've got, between our various services, you know, we've got energy, uranium, cannabis. We'd be looking to add to those positions. Home construction is another one that we'd be looking at.
Big tech has been the leader this year up until July. What do you see ahead for those stocks?
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the S&P 500, so that's all 500 stocks, it's up about 13% for the year. But if you look at just, you know, the group that's called the Magnificent Seven, so, you know, that's Microsoft, NVIDIA, Amazon, Apple, Tesla, Google, and Meta's the other one. So if you look at those seven stocks by themselves, they are, as a group, they're up over 50% for the year. But then if you look at the S&P 500 excluding those seven stocks, those other 493 stocks are up only 4%. So, yeah, very clearly, you know, big tech, especially those top seven, have been the big leaders here. And the main reason for those seven stocks being the big leaders, of course, has been that AI frenzy that we saw, you know, started a few months ago. But, you know, like all frenzies, you know, stocks get overbought and valuations become outrageous. And, you know, we saw NVIDIA, when it peaked there, it had a price-to-sales ratio of 50, which means that investors were willing to pay $50 for every dollar of sales. You know, to put that into context, you know, Meta, which is another one of the big seven, it has a price-to-sales of just 6.2. Now, that's reasonable. You know, you're paying $6 for every dollar of sale for a company that's been growing, it's dominant, makes sense. Paying $50 for every dollar of sale, that's crazy. So at some point, these things need to come back to earth. So we look for a stock like, you know, some of these big tech stocks, we're looking, targeting that. We see some pullbacks maybe into their 200-day moving average. So if we're looking at NVIDIA, you know, it's certainly the runaway champion here. Its 200-day moving average is $325. So that would be about a 35% pullback from its recent parabolic high. And it'd be about a $100 pullback from its current level around 4.25. So now, you know, most of these tech stocks are extremely oversold right now on this last little pullback. So we're starting to see a little bit of a rally here, but we'd be hoping that we get some, you know, a deeper pullback and a better buying opportunity for these.
When you were on last month, oil had just pushed through $85. You said if it can hold above $85, we should see $93, $94 oil. It just hit that level, so what's next?
Yeah, it's oil's just tracking just perfectly for our model. So, you know, oil, you know, it's continued a strong run. Like you say, it just hit under $94. It's looking today, it's trading at about $91. So, you know, oil's getting a little overdone, but it's starting to kind of cool back a little bit here. But that run, you know, we're looking at, you know, from June, you know, oil is trading at $66. So it's up about 40% in just a few months here. And one of the main reasons we're looking at is that, you know, the inventories are dropping. They're very low. You know, the inventory at Cushing, at the major oil hub there, it's at the lowest level since June of 2022. And to put that into perspective, right now in Cushing, there's 21.9 million barrels of inventory. But that's down from the peak of over 17 million a few years ago. And back when it was at 70 million, oil was trading at over $120. And today, with really low inventories, oil's only trading at $91. So something's going to happen. Now, another bullish driver for oil, of course, has been the Saudis and the Russians. You know, they cut production by 1.4 million barrels per day, and they've, you know, they continue to extend that. So they extended those cuts into year end. So, and then, you know, another bullish thing is, you know, we're seeing demand is continuing to be higher, particularly in gasoline, for example. So all those things have combined to keep pushing oil higher. Now, at this point, you know, oil is, you know, it's overbought. It was certainly overbought earlier in the week. Relative strength was at 78. And, you know, with anything over 70 being considered overbought, oil is very overbought. So we're seeing a bit of a pullback now. Short term, we could see a retreat into the mid 80 level. You know, on the bearish side, we've got, you know, we've got China having troubles, which is, you know, it's a huge oil consumer. We also have, you know, recession in Germany, Switzerland, and much of Eurozone, and potentially Japan. So near-term support, we're looking at around the $86 mark. If it falls through that, then we'd be looking at about $80 and then around 74. Near-term resistance is at 96, and then we'd be looking at $100. And I would expect to see that's going to happen sooner than later. Now, if we look longer term, you know, with, again, it looks bullish to us. You've got demand, you got India and these other emerging countries, they're expanding, and they need energy. They need electricity. So they're going to ramp up demand. You know, we've got China, which has been stalled here, but they've been, you know, they've been pushing a little bit of stimulus packages out. I expect they're going to do a lot more of that. And either way, China's going to get back on track at some point. And they're, like I say, a big consumer of oil. And then if you look at the supply side, you know, I'm pretty sure I've said the same story here, Jim, every time I come on, but you know, you've got a lack of investment. You know, we've got, you know, we publish rig count every week in the trend letter. And they just continue to decline. And so we've got, you know, capital expenditures in the oil sector that, you know, 35 to 40 year lows. And, you know, the main reason for that is we've got global government with their, you know, they got a hate on for fossil fuels. So they've increased windfall taxes. They've increased regulations. There's no new permitting. So, you know, if you combine all that, you got the demand and the supply issues, you know, you know, you're creating a huge supply problem for the next few years. So we've been saying, I know I've said in the last few times, we expect to see oil in the next year at $100. Well, you know, we're pretty close to that already. So I certainly expect we're going to see $150 oil or even higher in the next 3 years. So on pullbacks, we'd be looking to add. So some of the companies that I would recommend, some of the ones we've got in our portfolio now, you got MEG Energy, Crescent Point, XLE, the ETF. And plus we've got another of number of ones we're watching, Synovus, Baytex, Athabasca, and a bunch more. So there's some of those to consider if we get a nice pullback in oil.
What's going on with natural gas?
Oh, not much. You know, natural gas is just, it's almost been straight lining here. It's been consolidating since February, not doing much. You know, it's been trading between $2 and $3 throughout that period. Now it has been nudging up, this week. So this past week, we have seen a little bit of an uptick. Now primarily that seems to be based on, you know, maintenance interruptions. But again, so a lot of those things were being offset by larger increases in LNG shipments. But for your listeners, I mean, if you're a long-term investor, you might want to start considering a position here soon. I think that this winter will be much different than last, especially for Europe due to the El Nino. So according to, you know, most of the weather experts, you know, the coming El Nino is, you know, supposedly going to bring colder temperatures to Northern Europe, which will be a much different story than the warm winter they had last year. And say in North America, the expectation is for cooler weather in the east and the southern U.S. and warmer weather in the west. So again, if you're a long-term investor, I would really look at, you know, accumulating some in that, you know, they're on the 250 range. That would make sense. You know, a couple of ways to play nat gas. There's the UNG trace in the U.S. and in Canada, there's an ETF, the HUN.
Gold had a rough week. What do you see ahead for that precious metal and other precious metals?
Yeah, well, you know, The big problem for gold has been, you know, the U.S. dollar, strength in U.S. dollar. And, you know, as I, you know, I say all the time that all of these sectors are connected. And if people understand that, it all kind of starts to make sense. And that's what we sort of do every week in the trend letter. We kind of tie all these things together, trying to make it really clear to people why things are happening. So the U.S. dollar has been a real headwind for gold. And ever since the start of August, you know, gold has trended lower because the U.S. dollar has been trending higher. And it really got hit this last week. You know, it's dropped down today. Last I looked, it was at 1865 here on Friday. So, you know, since making that double top at 2070 in April and May, gold's been unable to break through and close above 2000. So now gold's oversold here. So we should start to see a bounce soon. Near-term resistance is now 1900, then 1925, 1975, and then that 2000 resistance that has been unable to break through. Next support would be 1860. So like I said, last I saw it was 1865. So that'll be the near-term test. And then we would get really strong support at 1825. And, you know, if it does drop to 1825, you know, our models are kind of triggering that that should be a really strong support level. And if it stops there and holds there, that would trigger some buy alerts for us. And then we'd be sending those out to our subscribers.
You posted an interesting chart on Twitter, now known as X, at the Trend Letter the other day, showing consumers are tapping out and using credit cards for necessities. What's the story there?
Yeah, well, you know, it's an important chart to see. And, you know, people can look at it on our Twitter site. And I'll post some charts from our Nook Talk here up on our market note on our website. Because consumers drive over 60% of the economy. So over the last decade or so, consumer credit, you know, credit card debt has been slowly creeping up. And the personal savings rate in the U.S., over the past decade, it's been pretty much, again, flatlining. It's been around 8%. You know, it dips in a little bit, but it never gets over 10%. And then we had COVID happen, right? And so COVID happened, you know, that led to the government, you know, doing, you know, globally locking down. And then that severely disrupted the global supply chain. And then we had the central bank step in and they, you know, they wanted to avert a big major economic crisis. And in the Fed's case, you know, they pledged to buy what they called unlimited assets. And what they did over a little over a two-year period is they bought over $5 trillion worth of assets over 2 years. So they were buying mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds to pump liquidity into the market and also to keep rates low. And then simultaneously, you know, the U.S. government, so it started with Trump and then Biden, they implemented these massive stimulus programs, basically sending out checks out to families and businesses. You know, Canada did the same thing. So over that period, the U.S. government sent out over $5 trillion in stimulus out into to the people. So between the Fed and the government, the U.S. pumped out over $10 trillion. So unsurprisingly, you know, the personal savings rate exploded. So it went from 8% in 2019 to get this, Jim, to 34% in 2020. And this is from the government stats. These aren't, you know, just some crazy shadow stats or something. This is government stats from 8% to 34%. It's never been hardly above 10%. So consumers had all this money and so they started to spend it and then, you know, and that created this whole new surge of demand for goods. And that was at a time supply chain was choked. And so the end result was we saw the U.S. inflation rise to over 8%. And that was before Russia invaded Ukraine. So as the people then began spending this money, the savings rates gradually started to decrease. And it got down to 13%. Then they did another stimulus thing and it bumped up again. But then it was the end of the stimulus. And so that pattern persisted until most of these funds got spent. So the savings rate then returned to more conventional levels. So today, credibly, the U.S. savings rate now, the personal savings rate now, is just 3.8%. So that is less than half of the average norm. So it went from 34% down to 3.8%. So now, You've got food, shelter, and energy still very high. Many consumers are now tapped out, and they're using their credit card to buy necessities. You know, credit card debt in the U.S. went from, you know, at, you know, to 2010, I'm looking at that chart here, it was at, you know, about $300 billion. Then it spiked there, kind of hung around, you know, just under $700 billion. And then now it's spiked up to over $1 trillion. So we've seen a rise in the last 2.5 years of $250 billion in credit card debt in the U.S. And, you know, in Canada, the numbers are similar. You know, household credit market debt in Canada, it translates to $1.85 of debt for every dollar of disposable income. So, you know, again, I'll post this chart because it's so dramatic. It's so dramatic. You see credit card debt just going up, you know, up to the sharp to the right, and personal savings dropping dramatically to the right. So, you know, it's not a very pretty picture, Jim, and I think we're going to see some real trouble ahead here.
Given that governments were a big factor in the rise in inflation, since those checks have been spent, shouldn't inflation be declining more than it has been?
Yeah, you know, certainly at a high level, that would make a lot of sense. But I think the problem is that, you know, it was such a dramatic rise in inflation and in such a short period of time that it takes a while for these other areas to react. I mean, it's all a cycle. So part of the problem is that the prices of essentials like food, energy, and housing, those costs have hit the average family hard. So now to the point where their paychecks just weren't covering their needs, right? So they're falling behind. So we started to see workers wanting wage increases because they need to catch up to this massive inflation that's happened so quick. And so what we're seeing now, you know, we've seen a number of strikes. You know, we here in BC, we saw the longshore workers, and in Ontario, we saw the auto workers just settle with Ford. So both of those settlements received large wage and benefit packages based, you know, through those strike actions. Today, you know, we've got the UAW in the U.S. They've just escalated their strike against the big three auto companies. You know, some of these demands are not just to catch up to inflation, but they're looking to lock in clauses that ensure that they keep up and keep ahead of future inflation. You know, just this morning, I just saw the governor of California just signed a bill that raises, so it's going to be law, going to raise fast food workers' wages, minimum wage, 30% to $20. So, and you know, to me, you can't blame the workers for wanting to catch up and keep up. But we have to remember that for most of the last decade, inflation was not an issue. It's only in the last couple of years. You know, generally inflation was between zero and barely nudging 2%. But now with all these large wage settlements, you know, we're going to have these companies have a much higher employment cost, and they're going to look to pass that on to consumers. And that's inflationary. So, you know, the UAW, so the auto workers in the U.S., they're asking a 40% raise over 4 years. So 10% a year plus. They want many other benefits. They want a shorter work week, changes to their tiered pay system, and they want stronger, better pensions. And again, that's all going to ultimately raise the price of vehicles, which are already at record high prices. So, and so that's just the auto industry. And then if we look at, you know, look at the pilots in the U.S., they've received substantial pay increases. Today, I just saw, you know, Air Canada pilots are picketing Toronto's Pearson Airport. Again, they're looking for higher wages. Government workers in Canada, they just settled for a huge package. I just think we're going to see more and more of these higher wage and benefit demands from all kinds of sectors. And as these negotiations get concluded, you know, I think the cost of all these higher wages will, in most cases, get passed on to consumers. And so I just think it all fits into why we're seeing higher for longer inflation, because it's just a trickle-down effect.
What about currencies, the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, you know, back to what we were talking before, you know, everything's connected. So when you talk currencies, it's really all about U.S. dollar. You know, if the U.S. dollar is strong, that negatively affects other currencies. It negatively affects commodities, equities, and precious metals as well. So, and we saw that in spades in the last few weeks. You know, we're seeing foreign capital, you know, since mid-July, we've seen foreign capital move into the U.S. dollar and out of primarily the euro and the yen. You know, these, as I say, these sectors are all connected. So the U.S. dollar has been in a downtrend from late September right up to the middle of July. But since then, it's been on a really strong rally, and it's up. It's all, almost 7% in the last 10 weeks. And the reason is that the U.S. dollar is strong because the U.S. interest rates are higher than other major central banks. I mean, well, to take an extreme example here, look at Japan. So just a Japanese bondholder, if he wanted to buy a Japanese one-year bond, he would get a negative 0.06 return. So he'd actually lose money. But if he went and bought a U.S. one-year bond, he would get 5.5% yield. So that's a 6% difference. I mean, that's massive. So, you know, if the ECB, so the ECB, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, and the Bank of Japan, if they all pause on their rate hikes and the U.S. yields remain higher, then, and the U.S. actually, and the U.S. could raise their rates even more, that would just make the U.S. dollar even stronger. So the current trend of a strong U.S. dollar and a weaker Canadian, weaker euro, weaker yen, weaker pound, it's all getting overdone in the short term. So I would say we should see a reverse here soon, at least temporarily. So looking at the U.S. dollar, you know, you got resistance at the 108 level. Right now it's trading at about 105, a little over 105. And I could see the U.S. dollar ultimately hitting about 115. Near-term support sits at about 104, then 102.75. Now, for Canada, like I said, you know, it's all connected to the U.S. dollar. So the U.S. dollar is strong, Canadian dollar is weaker. And it's been weaker since that mid-July where the U.S. dollar started to rally. So this week we saw the U.S. or the Canadian dollar get a little bit of a boost from all these higher oil prices and so on. But this morning we got GDP data out today. Basically showed that the Canadian economy was flat in July. So that suggests that all these rate hikes are now having an effect. And likely, the Bank of Canada would likely pause. And if they do, and the U.S. raises rates, well, that's going to hit the Canadian dollar even further. So Canadian dollar, last I looked, was 73.9, so just under 74. Key resistance right now would be 75. Key support would be about 73.25. But, you know, honestly, Jim, I think the Canadian dollar is going to drop below 70 in the next year. Now, if you want to look at the euro and the yen, in Europe, we've got 8 countries currently in a recession. So you've got Germany, Sweden, Netherlands, Hungary. So, you know, the recession's building over there. Yesterday, we saw inflation in Germany drop from 6.1 down to 4.5. So, you know, things are kind of turning down. Now, the question would be, what's what's the ECB going to do regarding rate hikes? Because, you know, you've got Germany is the largest economy in Europe. And if the ECB were to raise rates, then that's going to hurt Germany and these other 8 countries. And there's a bunch of other ones that are very close to falling into a recession. So, you know, the euro had a big sell-off from May of, 2021 to October 22. You know, it lost 23% of its value. And then from there, it recovered almost 16% up until mid-July. And so you notice mid-July is a big turning point for all of this stuff. So mid-July, the U.S. dollar started getting stronger. All these other currencies started going the other way. You know, the euro of all the currencies has a near perfect inverse relationship to the U.S. dollar. And since that mid-July, you know, the euro has really struggled. You know, it's now down about 7% since that turn. And again, the main driver has been investors moving capital into the U.S. from Europe, taking advantage of those higher yields and the belief that, you know, the ECB is going to continue to have lower rates than the Fed will. So the yen, you know, it's been in a big decline from November of 2020 right through November 2022. So it lost about 32% in that 2-year period. And then, you know, similar to the euro, it then recovered about 16%, but it's given back almost all of that since March of this year. And I'm pretty sure last time I was on your show, we talked about, you know, Japan's a mess. It's, you know, it's been in over 2 years of aggressive monetary easing, or so 2 years, 2 decades, and Japan's still in a deflationary environment. So, you know, all these other banks have been aggressively trying to fight inflation. Japan has not. You know, the U.S. Fed rate is 5.5%. Canada's is 5%. And Japan's is sitting there at negative 0.1%. So capital has just fleed the Japanese yen, seeking higher yields elsewhere. And most of that is coming to the U.S. dollar. So there's been a lot of expectations that the Bank of Japan is going to intervene here. You know, the last time the yen was this low, the Bank of Japan did intervene. The yen is very oversold here. So any intervention by the Bank of Japan would give the yen a pop. You know, a weak yen makes it really hard for Japanese consumers because they're a huge energy and food importer. And those prices, you know, are just so much more expensive because of the yen so weak. And that's been crushing, you know, the Japanese consumer.
Do you still expect a recession?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I sound like a broken record every time I come on. But, you know, all I do is I look at history, right? So historically, an inverted yield curve is a leading indicator of a recession. You know, a yield curve inverted is when the short-term yield is higher than the long-term yield. And today, the one-year U.S. Yield is paying 5.45%. The 10-year is paying 4.57. So almost a full percentage point different. So since 1955, there has been only one time, just one time, where the yield curve inverted without there being a recession. So this is a leading indicator, meaning that the inversion of the yield curve happens before the recession, you know, typically between 6 and 24 months. Well, the yield curve has been inverted, fully inverted since June 2022. So, you know, what's that? We're now like over 15 months into this inversion. So that suggests that if we get a recession, it's going to be happening probably in the first half of 2024. Now, there's another leading indicator. I think I've mentioned this one as well. Again, near perfect record of forecasting recession, and that's the Conference Board's leading economic index, you know, where it looks at about 10 different components across the U.S. economy. So in its latest report out this last week, it says, continuing to say, there's going to be a U.S. recession. So there, you know, there's a number of other indicators that are saying the same thing. So sure, you know, there's always the possibility that all of these indicators with near perfect records of calling recession will all be wrong. But I think it would be really foolish for your listeners to not have a plan to protect their investments if we do see a recession. Now, the good news is, you know, if we get a recession, you know, at the end of a recession, you get these great buying opportunities. You know, during a recession, stocks get crushed, you know, the stock markets crash. But once everybody's out of the markets, once they've, you know, thrown in the towel, that's when you want to have cash ready to scoop up the bargains. You know, the last five recessions have provided fantastic buying opportunities. You know, we had the, you know, in the early 80s, we had that tight monetary policy fighting inflation, just like it's happening today. What happened? Stock market crashed. But what happened after that? We had about an 8-year bull market. You know, we had, you know, the Gulf War in the early 90s. And, you know, same time the saving and loan collapse. What happened? Stock market crashed. And then we had like a 10-year bull market. Then we had the dot-com recession. Again, massive stock market crash. You know, I remember the NASDAQ was down 75 points or 75%. But again, you know, you had a nice, you know, 6-year bull market. And then you had 2008, we had that financial crisis, another big stock market crash. But since 2009, you know, we've been in like a, you know, 13-year bull market. So, you know, the key to me is, you know, if we do get a recession, have some cash ready, wait for our buy signals and jump in. Just one last thing too, Jim. Yeah. Just to wrap up maybe. I just want to make sure that, you know, if your investors, if your listeners understand how all these sectors are connected, then they're going to have a really much better chance of being successful. So just as we talked about, again, this is what we show our subscribers all the time. You know, since mid-July, we've seen the U.S. dollar be very strong and all these other currencies weak. At the same time, we've seen the U.S. dollar strong. We've seen the equities, commodities, precious metals weak. Now, all of these sectors now have hit these extreme overbought and oversold levels. So what we're, our models are telling us is we're probably going to see a reversal here very soon. So overbought, we've got right now the U.S. dollar and oil, you know, and we've got most oversold, we've got equities, precious metals, and bond prices. So we're very likely to see these, both these overbought and oversold conditions reverse. Therefore, watch for a pullback in the U.S. dollar, look for a rally in the euro, a rally in equities, a rally in precious metals. And then the big question, of course, is going to be, are these, expected reversals going to be short term, or are they going to represent, a longer term trend change? And that's what we do. You know, we watch and we highlight and then we send out alerts when we see these trends change. What we did, I think we did this last time I was on, again, we're trying to help out the Special Olympics. So what we'll do is we're going to offer some great discounts on our services. So between 40 and 65% discount, depending if it's a single subscription or some combination. So you can get those at thetrendletter.com/special-offer. And again, if anybody signs up for any of these subscriptions, we will donate $100 to Special Olympics. And again, for those products, you've got the Trend Letter. So that's out every week, every Sunday, covers all those sectors. Trend Technical Trader, which is that hedging service, but it also does long positions and it has the gold technical indicator. And then we've got the Trend Disruptors, which is covering those more speculative sector. And that's, again, for people that are willing to speculate. Also, Jim, it's really key is we do have our free, so that's free, daily headline service. So that's where we review what's happening every morning in the markets and we send out headlines that we think investors should be well aware of. And then, subscribers can then read the, simply read the headline, or if they want to get the detail, they just simply click on the link and they can read the article. And so if any of your listeners have any questions about our services or subscriptions or whatever, they can contact us at info@thetrendletter. So that's all one word, thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, my pleasure, Jim. Always good. Hope you and your listeners have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Wolf, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, before we get into the interview, can you tell us a little bit about Wolf Street?
Wolfstreet.com is my website. No politics, all business, finance, and money. We discuss just about everything that's of importance in that era. And we don't charge for anything, so it's all free. You don't have to sign up for anything. WolfStreet.com.
Wolf, where do you think U.S. stock markets are headed?
The stock markets have been driven by quantitative easing and by interest rate repression essentially since 2009, since the Great Recession. And that has fueled a gigantic run-up in stock prices. It got a little bit in trouble in 2018, 2019, when the Federal Reserve started hiking its policy rates and started unwinding some of its balance sheet through QT, quantitative tightening. And then we got the pandemic and we got a global worldwide surge of money printing, so quantitative easing and interest rate repression all over again. And this caused a huge spike in asset prices all around, including in the stock market. And that's over. So now we have the opposite. We have much higher interest rates. In the United States, our policy rates are at 5.5% roughly. Our long-term interest rates are coming up. They're getting closer to 5%. In the Eurozone, another huge economic area, they have 4% rates, and the ECB has unloaded over 1.5 trillion euros of its balance sheet. The Fed has unloaded almost 1 trillion. The Bank of Canada has unloaded a whole bunch too, and they just about all central banks have except the Bank of Japan. And they're still doing a little bit of QE, and they're doing, they still have negative policy rates, but it's just a relatively minor cog in this overall scenario of central banks tightening and tightening massively with quantitative tightening and interest rate increases. And this is something that the stock market cannot deal with. They have the stock, so in the United States in April, May, June, and into July, the Fed has bailed out the bank, so to speak, with a very quick $400 billion liquidity infusion that it then removed. So that's gone, and it removed another $400 billion roughly in assets from its balance sheet. So this is the fastest QE now ever, and stocks have gone down since the bank liquidity issues were removed. So this is really how it works. The stock market has ballooned with quantitative easing and with 0% interest rates. And now it's meandering lower. And we've had this surge in the spring and into July because of this $400 billion liquidity injection that's now gone too. So since the end of July, stocks have gone down quite a bit in the United States. The S&P 500 equal weight index, so that's the index that doesn't adjust for market capitalization, that just turned negative year over year. Negative for the year yesterday, and so we can see that the central banks are taking massive amounts of liquidity out of the system, and that has the opposite effect of putting it into the system, which they did before the after the financial crisis and then after the pandemic started hitting, and this is unwinding. You have to expect that the opposite happens to stocks than it happened during QE and interest rate compression. We're seeing that the unwinding, of course, is slower than the wind-up was, so this is going to take a lot more time. This stock markets in the United States reached a high in, so for the S&P 500, that was January 2022. So that was, that was almost 20 months ago. And for the NASDAQ, it was November 2021. And so that's close to 2 years ago. And they're quite a bit down from those points. And when you look at the long-term chart, it looks pretty bad. And it's all related to central bank tightening. And doing essentially having the opposite effect of quantitative easing and interest rate repression, and this is just logical. And these overvalued markets just are being repriced now based on this new environment.
Do higher energy costs lead to price inflation, which leads to higher interest rates?
Yeah. So. Energy costs hit consumers directly through gasoline, and that's when you go to the pump and you see the price go from, and here in the United States we have dollars per gallon, so this may not make a lot of sense in Canada, but it's $3, and then suddenly it's $4, and suddenly it's $5 a gallon, and that just hits you in the face. We drive so much, so gasoline is a big part of what people spend the money on, and so this has an impact on the perception of inflation just right away. And there are core measures of inflation that eliminate energy costs, which come up and down a lot. You have fuel prices; the price of oil spikes to over $100, and then it plunges, and so these are very inconsistent measures. So we have core prices, But the fuel price increases also filter into the goods and services that are in the core CPI indexes, so core inflation measures, and you know, airfares go up when jet fuel prices spike, transportation costs go up for goods, so they're being added to the price of goods when you buy them, when you ship something, e-commerce, there's a shipping charge on there, that goes up, and so over time, high energy costs filter into the standard goods people buy. Electricity costs go up when natural gas prices spike or coal prices, and so you have that problem that when you try to heat your home with electricity or run the air conditioner, you may have much higher bills than you used to have, and so these energy prices are all over the place now, and they're in the core measures and they're in the headline measures, and they plunged earlier in 2023 and in late 2022, but since then they've come up a lot. You know, they've come up, gasoline has come up really 8 months in a row now, and even though electricity and natural gas prices are still on the way down. And so the gasoline prices are now where they were a year ago, a little higher, and so that brings the year-over-year CPI measures up. And yet, so this whole thing is starting to filter into the inflationary mentality again. So we've seen the inflation increase in Canada. We've seen it increase in the United States, not only based on the headline measures, but also on the core measures. And you know, the energy is just a little bit in everything essentially. You can eliminate the surface measures such as gasoline from the index, but then you have the higher cost that companies have to deal with and that they're passing on in their other inflation measures. So energy is a very important component, directly and indirectly, of our inflation measures. And when energy goes up over the long term, inflation goes up.
Just how high will interest rates go in the U.S.?
So the short-term interest rates may or may not go a lot higher. The Fed will probably hike another 25 basis points this year, and that will bring the upper range of its policy rates to 5.75%. It may or may not hike next year, depending on what inflation does. Inflation is reheating again in the United States now. So, but they'll wait and see what's happening. But what is happening now is on the long-term rates, and they impact the economy much more than short-term rates do. So these are we can track that with the yields on Treasury securities, on 10-year Treasury securities. Here in the United States, they're now at 4.6%. They've risen a whole percentage point over the past 8 months or so, and they're heading to 5%, and they may be heading higher. And that's impacting mortgage rates. Our classic 30-year fixed mortgage rate is now over 7.5%, heading towards 8%. These are massive interest rates. We just went to buy a used car because ours got totaled. And in addition to the shocking price increase of the car itself, when I searched on the internet, I wasn't even looking for a car loan, but they priced me a teaser rate of 11% on our used car loan. You know, this is just kind of a shocker when you see that 11% on a used car loan on a used car that's costing 60% more than it did 2 years ago. So I mean, this is sort of a shocker people go through, and that's what these higher long-term interest rates do. They impact the stuff that people are actually buying, so houses that they're funding with borrowed money, houses, cars, mainly, and it impacts what companies are funding. So investment grade companies having to pay much higher yields on the bonds that they issue. Commercial real estate is in serious trouble because they have funded a lot of the debt with variable rate loans, and those rates are adjusting. They're doubling, from where they used to be. They went from 3.5% to over 7%. And these landlords say that you know, this project doesn't make sense anymore. I can't get enough rental income to cover the interest. And so they'll walk away from the loans and they'll walk away from the properties. We've seen that now happening all over the place, especially in the office sector. And we've seen it in retail. We've seen it in multifamily. And then they have, you know, these mortgages, commercial real estate mortgages are usually on a shorter term, so maybe 10 years and maybe even shorter. And then they have to be refinanced. Well, the loans that are coming up now have to be refinanced at 7%, 8%, or 9%. And when they were originally done, you know, they were at 3% or 4%. And, so a lot of these projects, these commercial real estate projects are in serious trouble because they have to refinance at much higher rates, or they're having to deal with variable rates that go up by a huge amount. So all over the real economy, we're finding that these much higher interest rates are having a big impact on profitability. They're having an impact on speculation. They're having an impact on corporate share buybacks, because now companies are having to buy shares with borrowed money that's a lot more expensive. And so the cash-rich companies that use cash instead of borrowed money, they can still do that. But companies that have to borrow, they're starting to shy away from it. So we're seeing a lot of that being wrung out, but at the same time, there is money being borrowed on very good projects, so very productive projects. Now the really good thinking is starting to kick in again finally, where a project has to be, an expansion project has to be justified, because now the money isn't free anymore. Now the money costs something. And so we're seeing a lot of good economic activity because of that. We're seeing construction on manufacturing facilities spike, and that's making sense. We're seeing all kinds of other good projects coming along where companies are spending money to build a future rather than to speculate in something. So there's some real impact on the economy. And I've always said that easy money turns brains to mush. It's a virus. Easy money is a virus. It turns brains to mush. But when the money gets more expensive, the good thinking starts kicking in, and this is all good, I think. This is finally a way to get the economy to be more rationally operated than just through mere speculation based on free money.
When the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Exactly.
How's the U.S. housing market doing?
Well, it sort of split in two. We've got the existing homes, so if these are used homes, where the sellers are not coming to grips with the new reality of the much higher mortgage rates. And so sales have collapsed. And they have collapsed to levels we haven't seen in years and decades. And there aren't a lot of sellers trying to sell. There aren't any buyers trying to buy. The people with the 30-year mortgages where they have 3% or less interest rates on it that don't change for 30 years, they're not buying. They're not selling either. They completely left the market. That's a big part of the potential buyers. So they're going to stay where they are. They're gone as buyers. They're gone as sellers. So now we have the people left that really want to buy, and they are having to face these 7.5%, 8% mortgage rates, and they can't buy, and many of them. And so, sales have just plunged on that side. Sellers need to come to grips with that. They need to understand that this is going to take a while, that these rates will be permanently higher, maybe never go back to 3%. And until they come to grips with that reality and start cutting their price, they'll just be sitting on their homes, and sales are just not taking place. On the new house side, so these are home builders selling homes, we have seen a dramatic shift there. Prices have plunged, so home builders have cut the prices. The median price of new houses sold is down by over 10%, and they are building at lower price points, and they're throwing all kinds of incentives out there. and they're buying down mortgage rates. Now, the incentives and the mortgage rate buy-downs are not included in the median prices. They're not captured by that. So this is in addition to that, and they're spending a lot of money to buy down these mortgage rates where they offer a buyer, say, a 5.5% mortgage when in the real cost of the mortgage is 7.5% and spread over a number of years. That's a substantial incentive that could be tens of thousands of dollars worth. And that is not captured in the home prices when they're being sold. So the effective price reduction among new houses is quite dramatic. And so sales have stabilized. They're down from they've plunged from the peaks in 2021, but they're down just a little bit from where they were before the pandemic. So they're not quite back where they were before the pandemic, but they're reasonably good given those price reductions, and they're now effectively competing with existing homes where sellers refuse to budge. So the prices, the median price of new houses and the median price of existing houses, they've come in line. They're almost the same now across the country. With the mortgage rate buy-downs, it may be a better deal to buy a new house than an existing house. And that's what buyers are looking at. And so that business, the sales have held up. Home buyers have been able to do that, and home builders have been able to do that because their costs have come down a lot. And, the labor costs maybe not so much, but the material costs have come down a whole bunch, and the time lags have come down, the completion times have come down, the shortages are gone, so they can adjust those. And many home builders have their own mortgage companies, so they, when they buy down those loans, they do that through their own mortgage companies, like automakers, like Ford Credit. They constantly buy down the car loans. You know, Ford offers 0% financing on some vehicles. That's a buy down through Ford Motor Credit. So home builders have adopted that model, and it's expensive, but they've been able to do that, and so far that end of the business has held up reasonably well compared to where it was before the pandemic.
Is Tesla shaking up the car market by dropping its prices substantially?
Yeah, that's something interesting to see. And I've worked in the car business and I've for 10 years, and I have nothing but horrible stories to tell about the legacy automakers and their corporate decision making. It is just horrible, and they have gotten into oligopolistic pricing with the pickup trucks, for example, and other models, where there's only in the United States there are only four automakers that make full size pickup trucks, and they have for 20 years jacked up prices to where pickup trucks are now incredibly expensive, and there has been no price competition from these automakers. So this is an oligopolistic pricing behavior. They have had huge, gigantic profits on these pickup trucks, and it's just outrageous. So now we get a whole bunch of EV makers to come in, and Tesla has threatened to come out with its pickup truck forever, and it's still not on the market yet, but closer. But we have Rivian with its pickup truck, and we have Tesla with its cars and SUVs, and so these price cuts are filtering into everything. Tesla has been brutal, and it has been able to do that because it has the highest profit margins among the major automakers. Its EVs are designed to be built more cheaply, and it's working hard on that. It's continuing to try to get its production costs down. And these the EVs sold in the United States are by Tesla are made in the United States. So these are not Chinese-made models that are sold elsewhere, like in Europe, where Tesla sells some of these Chinese models, even though it already has built plants in Europe. So yeah, these price cuts that Tesla is doing are a shock to the automakers, to the legacy automakers. They expected EVs to be a premium product. They expected to charge more for EVs than they would charge for their ICE vehicles. They thought this would be a luxury, near luxury priced segment, and that they could make lots of profits charging Americans an arm and a leg for these EVs. And Tesla came along and said, nah, we're not going for that program. We're going to sell our EVs for less than you sell your ICE vehicles. And that's exactly what happened. Tesla's Model 3, which is a near-luxury vehicle, sells substantially below the average transaction price in the United States for ICE vehicles. It competes directly with the BMW 3 Series. It underprices it by a whole bunch. And it goes through with Tesla's SUVs, the same thing. And now you have this American automaker that just completely revolutionizes the pricing theory in the United States. And then, of course, now the legacy automakers have this gigantic strike on their hand, and they can't do anything. And they're just in real trouble right now, and Tesla just won't let up. It's just brutal. It's just hammering on them, and it's taking market share, and it's growing leaps and bounds. And the other automakers are going to have to respond. And when Tesla comes out with its pickup truck, that's for Ford. Pickups, full-size pickups, are the core of its business. It essentially walked away from sedans. It's got SUVs and pickups mostly, and especially the full-size pickups, that's where a big part of its profits are coming from. And if Tesla starts siphoning off sales with its lower-priced pickup truck, that will be a very hard thing to deal with for Ford. And it has had to cut the price on its EV pickup truck, and because it's trying to overprice it, and it's just really hard for the legacy automakers now to deal with this. It just completely it came by surprise. It came out of the blue for them. Essentially, they never expected to have to deal with price cuts in the EV segment, and it's not just EVs. EVs are so popular now that they're eating into the market share of ICE vehicles. Toyota and Honda have gotten completely trounced in California by EVs. So Tesla is now the number one in California, ahead of Toyota and ahead of Honda. Unheard of for decades that an American automaker would be number one in California, and that's what we now have. Tesla's Model 3 and Model Y are the number one bestsellers in California, and that's starting to take place in other jurisdictions as well. So price cuts are hugely important, and Tesla is still making money with these price cuts. So that's the thing. It's not losing money. It's making money, and it's making a lot of money with these price cuts. So, it's fun to see oligopolistic behavior by legacy automakers to get crushed. I mean, I'm having a hell of a time enjoying this because I know how they operate. I know the decision-making they're going through, and I know how they've ripped off consumers over the years, and to see this happening is just a delight. I'm really glad it's finally happening. I've been looking forward to this for many, many years, and I didn't expect EVs would do it, but they're now doing it.
Now, I don't know if this is propaganda. The head of GM makes $29 million a year. It would take the average GM worker something like 340 to 360 years to make the same amount. Is that GM getting paid general manager being paid way too much?
Well, I think that's a separate issue. Yeah. And that's a problematic issue in general, not just the automakers. The huge discrepancy between work and pay in salaries, pay and benefits and pension plans and health plans, there's a whole package between workers and between top executives. That includes executive pension plans. We don't talk about that a lot, but these are incredibly rich pension plans that are separate from the workers' pension plans. It includes benefit packages, healthcare plans, all kinds of stock options, all kinds of things that workers don't get. So, that is a separate issue, how the income inequality has just ballooned. And it's not specific to automakers. It may be even less prominent among automakers than it is in some other industries. But that's an issue that's been well documented, and it's a bad issue. I don't have any solutions to that. But obviously, if a company's CEO doesn't manage the company very well and the company gets in trouble and goes out of business, yeah, there should be some punishment for the CEO, but there never is. They get extra millions of dollars in pay to lead the company through the bankruptcy, restructuring, and those kinds of things. And so there's never any drawback for executives to make mistakes. I mean, they can make mistakes and they get fired with a big settlement, and then they get another job somewhere and do the same thing. So that's a separate issue, needs to be addressed separately. I think the decision-making by the legacy automakers has been atrocious for decades, and they're kowtowing to Wall Street, and they're trying to do what Wall Street wants them to do, but Wall Street doesn't know how to make cars, and they don't understand the car market, and so they have completely destroyed their ability to compete in the market now. And now you have, yeah, the workers through the union trying to get their pound of the flesh, and that's completely the wrong time to do this. You know, these companies are losing out in a massive way against Tesla, and so now they're looking at 40% pay increases for their workers. And I hope they get this worked out somehow to where these companies have a legitimate chance to even compete with Tesla. You know, I don't want Tesla to get a monopoly here. You know, I've been looking forward to having lots of competition in the EV market, and that competition is lagging. These legacy automakers that make announcements, but they're not really accomplishing anything. They're still not really making a lot of EVs. And so it's, you know, this is a problem that the pay difference is a problem generically across the United States. The specific decision-making problems in the auto industry are unique, and they're unique among the legacy automakers. Tesla doesn't fit in there, so it started with a fresh sheet of paper, and it's just brutalizing the legacy automakers.
How are the new and used vehicle markets doing?
Well, I just mentioned my experience in buying a used car. Let me be a little bit more specific. We bought a two-year-old Ford Fusion Hybrid, paid $23,000 for it almost. And 3 years ago, we bought a 2018 Ford Fusion Hybrid, essentially the same. So we had a little bit better option on options on this package on this new one that we bought. But the 3 years ago, we paid $15,000 for what was then essentially the same vehicle. There were similar miles, similar age, and 2018 back then, now 2020. And the price went from $15,000 to nearly $23,000. It's just completely nuts. So across the used vehicle market, prices are up 60% roughly over that time span of those 3 years. And they have now hit a ceiling. They've come down a little bit, but not much. So used car buyers are facing these extraordinary prices out there. And now they're facing these high interest rates, like I mentioned a minute ago, 11% is what I was offered. We pay cash for it, but 11% is what I was offered to finance the car. And this is just a stunning change from where it was a few years ago. And many used car buyers have gone on buyer strike. We were on buyer strike too, except our car got totaled. We had to buy. And so used car volume has come down a little bit. There's still not a lot of inventory. The inflow into the used car inventory is low because rental car companies are not they didn't get the new vehicles for over the last 2 years that they needed to build the fleets because of the shortages. Now they're getting some of them, are getting quite a few of them, but they're still short, so they're keeping their units longer in the fleet. They didn't get a lot of them, so there are not a lot of units coming out of the fleet. During a normal year, rental car companies sell roughly 3 million used vehicles into the market, either through auctions or through their own retail outlets or to other dealers. That has been dramatically reduced. So there's just not a lot of supply in the used vehicle market right now. When you look at the inventories, there's some. You know, it's not like they're out. But there is not a flood of supply in the market. And so dealers are not pressured to lower prices. They don't want to lower prices because they have a cost in these vehicles, so they're trying to cling to those prices. And they're buying used vehicles at fairly high prices, so they're trying to protect the profit margins, and those profit margins are coming down a little bit. And so the used vehicle market is struggling right now, but dealer profits are still huge. There were just extortionately making money during the pandemic. And so they're coming down on those profits, but they're still huge compared to pre-pandemic times. We just heard CarMax report profits today, and they're making a ton of money still. It's just coming down from the last year. And it's still a huge amount of gross profit per vehicles. Yeah, they're still haven't cut prices like they should cut to bring volume up, and they're not having to do it because there's still not a whole lot of supply. So that's the dynamic in the used vehicle market. New vehicles are completely different. New vehicles are hot. There's pent-up demand for them. Sales are up roughly by the double digits. Have been all year. In September, they'll be up by about 15% something like that. Fleet sales are very strong. Retail sales are very strong. There's plenty of supply for most automakers. There's some that have short supply, but for most of them, they're pretty decent supply. So new vehicles are selling, and prices have stabilized. They're not going up anymore. The addendum stickers are gone. The automakers have added some incentives, not as much as they did in 2019, not nearly as much, but they've started to add some incentives, so that brings pricing down a little bit. And so we have this fairly strong new vehicle market, and where there's activity and automakers are buying down the interest rate. So you can get 3.9% financing or 0% financing or 2.9% financing. And that's stimulating sales. So that's doing good. And that's in dollar terms, that's a big part of the market. And there are estimates now that consumers spend a record amount in dollar terms on new vehicles in September. In terms of unit sales, that's what I was talking about. They're up 12 or 15% year over year in a number of units, but they're still down from the levels before the pandemic. But in terms of growth from where we were a year ago or 2 years ago, they're coming up quite a bit.
Wolf, how can people sign up for your newsletter?
Come to wolfstreet.com. Everything is free. Don't need to sign up for anything. We do have an email service that lets you know when we come out with a new article, and you just click on that. There's a sign up for under every article for that. And the easiest thing is just come to wolfstreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Strafe, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.